Our next speaker is Randy Willingham. He's a professor here at Harding, and he's going to talk to us about the feminization of Jesus.
Okay, I'm missing a slide, so I may have a creative experience here, but that's okay. I'd like for you to just go through a brief exercise with me and call to your mind the person you think of when you consider the person you know who's the most evangelistic. You know, don't say that person, but just call that person to your mind. Who is the most evangelistic person you know? Got it? Now, raise your hand if that person is a female. Look around the room. Raise your hand if that person is a male. Look around the room. Why is that? I find that pretty interesting. And I'd like to go to last night. I enjoyed the interaction with Wes, or listening to him. And one of the things that he said was, we need a new breed of minister. And so if we're going to look at the new cutting edge, what's the new cutting edge of a new kind of a minister? And what is it that we need to really be effective? In Wes's research, effective campus ministries have focus. Did you catch that last night? Did you also catch that it is an external focus? They don't have focus. They have a focus outside of themselves. I would argue that there's something about that that is inherent to the male. This is the one I was looking for, so we may be on track after all. Just want to let you know that I am grateful to be here. I'm also grateful we don't have any ladies in here. It'll be interesting to see how this is received among you. I would guess that this might make some of you a little awkward because this is the kind of conversation that's very easy to misunderstand. So you're going to have to stay with me, give me a chance, give me a hearing here. I want to let you know that the notes that I'm showing you here are on my webpage, so if you care for those, they're certainly available. Now, what would make me think that the church has been feminized? Where would I get that idea? Is it? I don't know what would give me the idea that the church has been feminized. We'll come back to this. But the conversation is very difficult because we do have a history. Tertullian said that women are the devil's gateway. I would say that Augustine, or Augustine, however you pronounce his name, whatever your preference is, was pretty influential. And he says that women are not made in the image of God. Now, we're not just talking about some bubba who sits on the back row of the church and is on the margins of church life here. We're talking about a dominant influence in the way Christians today think. Aquinas agreed with Aristotle and said that women are misbegotten males. You've heard of Luther. And he says God made Adam the head of creation and the woman spoiled it all. Some have said that Karl Barth would be a major, major theologian. That when we look at the history of the last century, he may be the theologian, possibly. And he said that the woman is ontologically subordinate to the man, which is her head. Now, when he says that she is ontologically subordinate, he means that in her essence, she is inferior. These are major theological voices. let's see, we go to some other, not churchmen, but church women. But they don't like to say women because you have men in that word, and they don't want any association with the male, it seems. Because Mary Daly, who's a prominent feminist theologian today, says the original sin is sexism. If we're going to get anywhere, we must castrate God. That's a quote from her. Rita Brock says, the doctrine that only a perfect male form can incarnate God fully and be salvific makes our individual lives and female bodies a prison against God and denies our actual, sensual, changing self as the locus of divine activity. Hayward said, believing in Jesus Christ as Lord is an insult to women because it condemns them to constantly look up to a man for inspiration, for leadership, for role modeling, and for redemption. Let's go back to Mary again. She says there is no way that Jesus can save women because no man can enter the experience of a woman. So on the one hand, you have major theological voices that have influenced Christian faith and the way that we think today, who have this, at least from my perspective, a clear, ungodly view of men and women. And then you have a legitimate response to some of that kind of thinking, and it responds just as much in an ungodly way. And it makes it very difficult in a toxic conversation to even be heard. And so I would acknowledge that it is a difficult conversation. What makes me feel like this is a worthwhile conversation? I believe it's much deeper than genders. I think it's deeper than the role of women. Whenever I'm talking about the feminization of Christianity, I am not talking about the role of women. I argue across the country that it is a mistake for church leaders to focus on the issue of the role of women. So I'm not going to do that here, but I will tell you that if you look at the Harding Bible faculty, I am not the most progressive person on the role of women in that faculty. But I'm probably the second or third most progressive. There may be one, there's possibly two people who would be more progressive than me on the role of women. What I am comfortable with in terms of women doing in the church context is something that would make many people very uncomfortable. And so whenever I'm talking about the feminization of Christianity, I'm not talking about whether or not the women can pass the Lord's Supper or can give a devotional or even can preach. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that is different than that. This ultimately is not about the gender stereotypes and what we tend to think of with men, what we tend to think of with women. It is true that whenever you go home and you just watch the people in cars where there are couples, predominantly women will be passengers and men will be drivers. Predominantly. Now that's going to be true tomorrow. That was true yesterday. That's true today. There are exceptions to that, but that is the rule. There's something there about a male and something there about a female. But that itself even is not ultimately what I'm after here. Whenever I'm talking about the feminization of Christianity, I mean that the church has embraced femininity in a way that rejects masculinity. There is research in this country that argues that women are more religious than men. But if you study Muslims, you're going to come to the opposite conclusion. We have been hijacked by a cultural agenda, and we're not aware of this. And that drives our approach to the role of women and a lot of other things in church. We've done it in a way that has rejected masculinity. It has shaped our understanding. Our understanding is more shaped by social science than by biblical revelation. Now, if you just read the popular literature, Willard Harley's book, His Needs, Her Needs, Gary Smalley's book, read the literature that is out, and the message to women is this. Listen, the reason you're not sexual, and that is the major thing your husbands want from you, ladies, and the reason you're not sexual is because he does not have enough affection for you. And if he was just wise enough to give you the affection you need, you would be a sexual machine for him. That's a major message of the popular literature. And we get co-opted in this, and we lose our message that we have. Now, what are some evidences of feminization? What am I talking about here? Well, it's going to tie back to what I have borrowed from Wes from last night. That effective campus ministries are going to have an external focus. We are hyper-internally focused. That is a product of us adopting the cultural agenda of feminization. Not only that, but we see a love that nurtures and embraces. I can hug you. And that's what it means to be a man. Jesus will hug you. That's what it means to be a man. But then there's another kind of love that is distant, and it is that coach that says, listen, you need to push yourself more. I told my son not too long ago, I said, listen, if you want to be comforted, you go see mama. If you want to grow up, you better accept my challenge. Now that's the difference in a man and in a woman. Now, do my sons need mama's embrace? Absolutely. Absolutely. But they also need something that a woman cannot provide like a man can. The family focus. Churches are plagued with a family focus. We have a major mistake we've made theologically. We assume that the church is a family, and the church is not a family. I am not in an incestuous relationship by marrying my sister in Christ. Whenever I say that the church is a family, the meaning is that the church is like a family. It's like a family. And that's crucial. That's a major part of understanding the church. But at the same time, if you don't understand that the church is not a family, it's like a family, then you can't distinguish and see really what that means and how that applies and how that plays out. And we have a family focus in church that is the product of our feminization. We have sin passes for women. We make all kinds of excuses for women that we would never make for men. And then we have feminized masculinity. When you listen to churches pressure men to be better fathers, what they really are is a secondary mother. Look at the characteristics of good mothers. And what this is pressure for them to be an extension of the mother. What the kids need is more mama. They don't need something that's different than mama. They need an extra mama because there's not enough mama to go around. And so if we can get daddy to be mama, then they're really being spiritual. These are, to me, evidences of the problem with feminization. Now, this is from me. The problem with the church today is that it is focusing beyond itself too much. That's the problem. This is irony. We need more internal focus, don't we? Is that what we need? We should realize the church is like a family, and if we do not care for our own family, we're worse than unbelievers. I can even quote Bible on that. Women tend to be more concerned about family and less concerned about such things as competition, ego, and achievement. So perhaps we could make the church more sensitive to itself if we could only straighten out the role of women question and unleash the most spiritual asset of the church, the women. What about that as an agenda to really, really get us out there? I want to go back to last night because I think sometimes we need to listen to what we ourselves say, and I was impressed with the message last night. Community is not an end, but a means. Did you hear that last night? When I heard that, I thought, glory to God. Good. That's right. Effective campus ministries have focus, external focus. West said, Christ-centered community. Here is what they have, and he gave some characteristics. Number four was the community core is sold out for mission, as seen in three ways. And the number one was it was outwardly focused and constantly building relationships. Now, notice that, because there's a significant piece of insight here. The church is headed for trouble if we don't get off issues. Christianity is not an issue-based religion. Christ didn't die for us to straighten out our intellectual conclusions. Christianity is a relational-based reality. And so we need to be relationally based, relationally focused, relationally driven, not issue-based, focused, and driven. And yet, whenever I say the church needs to be relationally based and come out of that core, some people hear that we need to be internal. It's a matter of us hugging and loving on each other. That's not just it, but it's a matter of getting out there. And so this is external, but it is external in a relational way. Now let's just begin looking at some of these. A love that nurtures and embraces versus a love that protects and provides. You can't see this very well, can you? I tried. On the left, you have a fireman rescuing a child. He's looking outward. He's caring for this child. On the right, you have a fire lady holding a child, rescuing a child. If you could see those pictures with clarity, you would see something of the difference. One picture just feels differently than the other one, doesn't it? It just feels different. It is significantly different. There is in men this intuitive, deep drive to protect, which means you have the capacity to be offensive. It means that you have the capacity to have some degree of aggression. It means that whenever you think about shepherds, you don't just think about coddling the sheep, but you think about praying to God, like you're facing Goliath, God, please give me a rock, and I swear to you, Lord, I will throw it. And I won't feel guilty for throwing it either. And God, whenever I throw the rock you give me, I will aim for the head. Because I understand, God, that there are wolves, and that shepherding does involve protecting as much as it involves embracing. There's just something about that. There is this drive to provide. Now, this is different when I actually had a little video here that I thought about showing you. Perhaps some of you have seen this, but Sheriff Jolly was cleaning up after a tornado, and as he drives by a place, he sees out of the corner of his eye something moving. He thought it was a doll, and he picked it up, and it was this little baby. Now, I can give you the link. You can go to it on the right. It's hard to see. But this is a little baby, and he has this little baby set on the police car. And the little baby doesn't want to be separate from the sheriff. The little baby's going like this and crying. Now, this baby can't talk, but the baby can cry. And you know what the sheriff's doing in the video? Trying to talk to the baby. Are you okay? Everybody doesn't understand that. But the sheriff is saying, are you okay? Huh? Okay? Are you okay? Now, there's just a distance that is there often in a man. I love my sons as much as my wife loves my sons. But I have a capacity to love them with a little more emotional distance. And the emotional distance does not mean I don't love them. It's a different kind of love. I can leave the house. I can go. I can be a workaholic. And in my mind, I can do this to provide for my children. And that is an act of love that we criticize like crazy in the church. I'll tell you, I had a dad that didn't provide. And it is an act of love for a father to be sacrificial and work his fingers to the bone. And maybe he wasn't there as much as you wanted, but Mama was. There's just something about this capacity to love and to do it without being right next to the person when you're loving. Provide and protect versus nurturing. This is deep into human nature. I think it's inarguable. This is a special that was run, and it was entitled Making People Talk. Now, what do you do whenever it's not politically feasible to torture? And you've got to get information out of somebody. And so here's a special on how experts get people to talk without physically torturing them. And one of the things they did was they took these volunteers, and on the right, what you have is an interrogator who takes a female and slams her up against the wall and begins asking her about the guy's name who will not talk, who's tied up in a chair. And the experts say the reason they do this is they want to torture a woman in front of the male because that will often, when nothing else will work, will get a man to talk. Because there's this natural inclination in a male to be willing to fight the battle and protect. And so we exploit that natural tendency to protect. And you begin feeling guilty. You begin having a particular perception of yourself where you think you're worthless. And so we don't fight the battle in church because we're told the key is to make sure there are no battles. We want harmony at home, harmony in the fellowship. And we wonder why strong personality men are often not involved. What makes me think the church is feminized? Again, feel the picture. Feel it. Wes doesn't. It draws you in. I just have to prove I can hug. Come on. Some people don't believe we can hug.
Well, the picture already had me feeling warm and cozy.
I know. It does. It draws you in for a hug, doesn't it?
It does.
But contrast that with some other material written. Leadership strategies, decide now, plan later, how to get to the top technology, how to get the top technology talent that your company needs. Now, just imagine that you've got two deacons in the foyer of the church, and you've got these two, but imagine that leadership strategies, rather than being oriented toward business, let's just imagine that it's oriented toward church life and leadership in church life. Which one do you think the guys are going to pick up? I'm nervous about the guys that picked that one up. I mean, I love them. But hey, there's something missing. There's something missing. One, you feel action. You feel, and there are no pictures even. What if you had pictures? And you could do that visually as well. And so this on the right has a major disadvantage because it's all text. It doesn't have any visuals. But what if you had the visuals that were comparable over here mixed with this idea of how to make decisions in church rather than just repeating conversations? Would that have any attraction to you? You know, my wife says, let me tell you what happened today. And whenever she tells me, I start trying to fix it, right? And she says, no, you always try to fix it. I say, okay, I'm sorry, I forgot. I'm just supposed to listen. I know, and you're supposed to tell me everything's going to be okay. Okay, honey, everything's going to be okay. You just said that because I told you to say that. You know what I'm talking about? You see, they can just repeat the conversation. We need to fix something. And so this nature of love, the male nature, the male kind of love, is really diminished in church life. And another way you can tell that is look at how we monitor achievement. It's getting along, and everybody's happy, and so we know things are well. It's not how much of an impact did we make in the community. We know that we upset some community leaders here, but how much of an impact did we make in the community? No, it's not that. We measure ourselves very differently. Another factor here is the family focus. Now, men can have a family focus, but women are going to be more prone to that. They're going to be more prone to that than men. Now, you can look in the Bible and you can see different voices. They're not contradictory, but they are complementary. And in the New Testament, you do have, over on the right, the idea that it's ungodly for you to say, I'm going to not take care of my family. If you don't take care of your family, you're worse than a non-believer. Not only that, but Jesus taught that if you're not caring for your aging parents and you're giving those financial resources to the temple or the church, making some contribution to God and using that as an excuse not to care for your family, that's hypocrisy. Jesus taught that you should keep the command to honor your father and your mother. But the emphasis of the New Testament is exactly opposite. The problem the New Testament speaks to is not to one where people are neglecting their families. It's to where they make their families the center of everything else. And so Jesus says in Luke 14, you have to hate your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your wife, for the sake of the kingdom. There is this tendency to think that whenever Jesus came, he came to bring peace, not a sword. And you certainly don't believe that he came to bring a sword within the context of your family. Now that is the major point of the New Testament that's new. The emphasis on family was always there. It was one of the major markers for Jewish religion. And the New Testament message challenges that by saying, listen, you need to make sure that you are putting your family in the place it ought to be rather than exalting it too high. Now, let me just ask you to consider this. Interesting quote, and here I speak quite frankly as a bachelor, says C.S. Lewis, because it is a reason you can see better from outside than the inside. He says, if you're inside of the family, if you're married, you're not going to see this as clearly, but if you're not married and you're watching married people, then you're going to see something. The relations of the family to the outer world, what might be called its foreign policy, must depend in the last resort upon the man, because he always ought to be, and usually is, much more just to the outsiders. A woman is primarily fighting for her own children and husband against the rest of the world. Do you hear that? He goes on, naturally, almost in a sense rightly, their claims override for her all other claims. She is the special trustee of their interests. The function of the husband is to see that this natural preference of hers is not given its head. He has the last word in order to protect other people from the intense family patriotism of the wife. If anyone doubts this, let me ask a simple question. If your dog has bitten the child next door, if your child has hurt the dog next door, which would you sooner have to deal with, the master of that house or the mistress? Or if you're a married man, a married woman, let me ask you this question. Much as you admire your husband, would you not say that his chief failing is his tendency not to stick up for his own rights and yours against the neighbors as vigorously as you would like? See, a little bit of an appeaser. Now, this is a powerful argument that I think we have failed to hear. And that is that there is something about family that is inherently selfish. You see, family, speaking of the insiders and the outsiders, you're in the family or you're not. I would make this distinction, and this is something I do in my Christian home class, and that is I've written some material on this for my class, and it's entitled A Journey to the Pedestal. Because the Christian family needs to make a journey, and that is to remove itself from the center of the throne of God. My family is not what everything centers around. If everything centers around my family is an idol. And the Bible teaches that I must honor my family, but I don't worship my family. And so I need to exalt my family up to a pedestal. I need to put my wife on a pedestal. But my wife needs to have a clear understanding that when push comes to shove, and it always does, that Christ is first. I would suggest that this gets into the next point. And I'm going to come back and weave this in with the family idea. But we give women a free pass a lot of times when it comes to sin. I remember I thought I had something cool on Mother's Day. I just got up and I said, you know, tell you what, when I start thinking about people who are not in church like they ought to be and not doing what they ought to do, often it's the man. And you know, your wives would love to tell you something and they just don't have the nerve, or sometimes you're not listening because you think they're nagging. I tell you what, for Mother's Day gift, what I'm going to do is tell you what you need to hear. And I hammer the husbands for the wives. After that sermon, there was an old Bubba deacon. He cornered me. I remember he used his belly to push me into the corner of the room. He was bigger than me, as all people are. He pushed me into that room, literally with his belly. And he just said, son, I just want to know, when it comes to be Father's Day, you going to do the same for the men? Well, I wasn't planning on it. Listen to our Mother's Day sermons. Listen to the message in church that we give to women as opposed to men. It is different. It's not the same. You know, we say that if you don't give your wife affection, then obviously she might end up in the arms of another man because he cares about her. But whenever we hear about a woman who shuts herself off sexually from the husband and ends up in an affair, you say, you should never use that as an excuse. And he shouldn't, but neither should she. And we tend to justify the one and not the other. There's a CNN special I can get for you. I've used it in some of my classes. And in the CNN special, they're talking about adultery. And of course, they have an evolutionary view for why adultery occurs. But they begin sociologically looking at what has happened because adultery is very much on the rise. And you know why it's on the rise? Now, this is CNN. This isn't the Church of Christ. CNN argues. Their special argued that it's on the rise because women have gone into the workforce. And that's where most affairs begin, is in the work context. And so you have this radical jump in terms of women having affairs at work. You know, we've thought before, well, women, they're not as likely to have an affair on their husband as a husband is on their wife. Do you know why that's been the case? The reason that's been the case is because they didn't have the opportunity, because they were at home. Here's the truth you need to nail down. Romans 3:23, there is no difference, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. A female is just as much a sinner as is a male. There's a tendency more so to blame. If I talk about this CNN special, I will automatically be thought of as trying to say women shouldn't be working. But we blame this on the men. And we should accept some responsibility. I'll tell you this. Have you ever heard of promise keepers? Have you heard about the idea of droves of men getting together and saying, we are going to confess and admit that the problem in our families is us. Where is the female organization that is comparable to that? Where's the female organization that has risen up and said, you know, our children are killing each other when they go to elementary school? And we are stepping up to take responsibility for that. Is motherhood relevant to that? If motherhood is relevant, it bears some, not all, some responsibility for that. Where is the message from the women that says, we have sinned? We expect that from the men. We're terrified to ask that of the women. We think if we ask that of the women, then we're chauvinists. Is motherhood selfless or selfish? This is a question I ask in my Christian home for conversation. Listen to the Mother's Day sermons. They're near angelic. They're not even human. Now, you know this passage here where Jesus is approached by the mama of two of his disciples. And the question is, can they sit at your right and your left in your kingdom? Right? This passage shows the beauty of motherhood and the ugliness that C.S. Lewis talked about. The beauty is this, that the mother will do anything. She will die. She will do anything to promote her children. The ugliness is this. It doesn't matter if that hurts your children or not. I've had mothers call me and say, Dr. Willingham, you just don't understand. I just wanted to make you aware. Little Johnny's in your Christian home class, and he's just a wonderful young man. But I tell you what, he has struggled so much. And just wanted to let you know that we're aware that he's struggling, and you might have to give him some special attention. I have never had a mother call me and say, Dr. Willingham, just want to let you know that little Johnny has had many more opportunities than most of the kids in your classroom. And we are letting him have one last opportunity, but he doesn't really want to be at Harding. But this is his last opportunity for us to provide support for him. And we just do not want you to feel guilty if it looks to you like there's a more appropriate kingdom investment in somebody who hasn't had the opportunity, but is more eager for it. You want to make me rich? Let's just take bets on whether or not I'm going to get that call. That is the ugliness of motherhood. It will even justify murder. This is a true story from my ministry where a lady was concerned because the leadership had not reached out to her daughter. We should reach out to her daughter. We tried. But her daughter was living with her boyfriend and was really not interested in us at all, but she wanted Mama to think she was. And so we go, we talk with her. She doesn't respond. And so, of course, it's our fault. It's not hers, right? Because it's never my baby's fault. It's your fault. And so we do the best we can. And the young man that her daughter was living with went into a restaurant when they were about to close, and he took three people into the back room and shot all three in the head and murdered them in cold blood. Well, we are quick to respond, provide ministry to help, to reach out. And I'll tell you what, the message is that we should have reached out to him because the young man who pulled that trigger had no opportunity. And we should have been reaching out more to him. How would that story have been different if it was one of her children that was killed? That is the ugliness of motherhood. But also you see the beauty. God has given in a woman this capacity for protecting and caring for her own, even if yours is a threat. Let me just ask you. I'm telling you, we give them a free pass on this. If the vote were determined by the women alone, would we be more likely or less likely to have a pro-choice or a pro-life president? You know the answer to that. Just do your homework on the data, and you preach that on Mother's Day. You take that to the pulpit. How do you think it would be taken? You'd step right into the feminization of the church. Women, of course, have no responsibility for massive, widespread abortions, do they? Men are the ones who will abandon their children. That's the message we get, isn't it? Who do you think is killing those children? And you want a hot topic, jump into that. And yet, it makes us pretty nervous. Don't mind hammering the guys, but now the women, that's just a different deal. Now, we have until 5 o'clock, you said, right?
Yeah.
So we've got a while. I'm going to maybe even get some of this finished, and you'll have a chance to beat on me afterwards. And I will welcome that. Not that I like beatings, but if you correct me, that's good. Okay, I've given that to say that I believe that we have been hijacked by cultural agendas. Okay? That's not the first time. That frequently happens. Just look at the history of Christian universities and the issue of racism. And you can see some interesting realities there. That's not any different today. And we tend to go with that which is not going to create issues for us. And so we find ourselves in a church situation where the church is feminized. I'm going to give you some biblical insights on men and women and try to explain why I believe this is such a problem. But I'm going to show you two things first. One is the pictures on this slide. And I would like for you to notice, somebody sent this to me on email. And they sent this complaining about women drivers. That is a lady driver. A woman was confused between the subway and a parking lot, I guess, you know. Yes, it's a woman. Don't ask me how she did it. Now, I don't know what it is, but my youngest son, who started driving when he was 16, he's not 16 now, but at that time he started driving. And so we're letting him drive all that we can let him drive. My wife and I are in the car. He's driving, and he's wanting to pass somebody, and he can't pass them, and he's frustrated. He's griping, complaining, and we're just watching him. And finally, he passes the driver, and when he passes, he says, "I knew it was a woman." And my wife says, "Now, where does he get that kind of an attitude?" "I don't know, baby. You know he doesn't get it from me." "Well, where does he get that?" "I don't know. I think he's just born with it." There's this attitude. There's this stereotype. Now, whenever you look at the insurance premiums we pay, I guarantee you we pay a lot more for my son than somebody else pays for their daughter. So it's a stereotype that's really not fair to them. But it's there. We don't like directions, do we? One of the things you can do, you can get a battle going easy. If I wanted to split a church, what I would do is I would appeal to and exploit the gender, but I wouldn't call it gender. I would definitely focus us on Bible study about the role of women. I would definitely do that. And I would then exploit this. And I'll tell you, whenever I ask men to do this exercise, right on the chart, right on the board, all of the things you can think about women that get on your nerves, and the women on the other side of the room, write all the things you can think of that men do that get on your nerves. And whenever they do that, it's a very common list. Every single time, it ends up very much the same. Why is it that women go to bathroom in herds? Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
They do that, don't they? And then one of the ladies said, well, why do the men shower together? Talking about athletes, you know. Why do you check out a skanky girl and then you tell us you don't want us to be that way, but that's what you keep looking at? Why don't you ask directions? Why do you think you have to fix everything? God, it just goes on and on. Hints don't work. Subtle hints don't work. Subtle hints don't work. If you want something, tell us. Why, there is, in my wife, I believe my wife's a very intelligent woman, but if she thinks differently than me, how do you get into this deal? Honey, what I want you to tell me is that everything's going to be okay. And so I told her just today, just before I came here, I said, honey, I hugged her. I said, I know you're not going to want to hear this because you told me to say this, but I'm only saying it because it's true. Honey, everything's going to be okay. I know why you're saying that. We're different. We're just different. Now, what you see is that it's intentional. And so, back to the book of Genesis, God said, let us make man in our image and our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, over livestock, over the earth, over creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God, he created him male and female, he created them. Stop right there. Notice what he does. God says, okay, I'm going to create two human beings. Both are going to be in the image of God. A man and a woman are in the image of God. Now, your gender is temporary. Do you know that? At least relative to marriage. Because whenever Jesus is arguing with the Sadducees, marriage is temporary, it's not permanent, right? You're not marrying in the next life. And in fact, you get in a bad marriage, hang on, it will end. People get divorced because they think they have to live in this forever. You don't. It's going to end. It never was designed to be permanent. It was always designed to be temporary because marriage is not an end in and of itself. It's a means to another end. That's crucial. Preach your wedding sermon and focus till death do we will part. This is a temporary arrangement. It's not eternal. And yet, whenever we recognize this, I understand that I have something in common with my wife that is the bridge of understanding. I can understand her even beyond our gender because we're both in the image of God, and it is more important to be in the image of God than it is to be a male or a female. Being in the image of God is more fundamental to who you are than your gender. Your gender is a particular expression, two different ways to express this. But it's basically the image of God. Now, what I would like for you to do is just do a little Bible study, look at that paragraph right there, and just look at what you believe the writer wants to emphasize. Now, you know what the writer wants to emphasize by what he can't quit saying. You know what the writer wants to emphasize by what the writer repeats. That's what's repeated. Let them rule over the livestock, over all the earth, over all the creatures. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over, and rule over the birds of the air, and over. You are designed to exert power. And the female is designed to exert power in two fundamentally different kinds of ways. In the image of God, when you look at this, what is God doing? Well, God, in context, is creating. And then he is managing that which he creates. And we are in his image. And a part of the way in which we are in the image of God is that just as God exerts power over something, we are designed by creative intention to exert power over something. And we feel guilty when we talk about power. And the reason is because we've abused it. But you cannot not exert power. We are designed to exert power over something. But because it is the man and the woman, it does come out differently. Now, one of the things is that the nature of the gender, the very fact that there is a connection between male and female, and the nature of that gender, that is the basis for the female exiting her family of origin and beginning a new family. Let me give you another way to say this. Dealing with your gender is your biggest key to growing up. Your effectiveness and willingness to deal effectively with a gender you are not is one of the biggest keys to whether you grow up or not. Now, that has huge implications for homosexuality. I mean, you can unpack that. Now, I find myself struggling because she is different, but the truth is there are needs within me that my wife can meet. I met Matt, and we've got a handful of wrestlers here. Have you noticed how ugly some of these ears are? And your name was?
TC.
Look at his right ear. Look at how ugly that thing is. Now, the interesting thing about it is he probably likes it. Do you like yours?
Yes.
Yeah, I like mine too. Mine's just flat. I used the needle. You didn't use the needle, did you?
I did, but
really?
I just got tired of it. It kept coming back. So
you got tired, so you quit using the needle, and that's all. It looks better. Yours is more obvious. They got to be really looking for mine. Yours. Oh, you? Okay. All right. You know, I tell you, whenever I've lost track now of what I was saying. What's that?
Something about ears.
Something about ears. Well, I forgot. We'll come across it. Yeah, there you go. Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you. Now these guys right here, you're my man today. Okay, now I'm an athlete in the past, not anymore, but I used to be. I'm a used to be. All right? And I can still beat you in wrestling. You can't believe that, can you? I'm a 50-year-old man. I can still beat you. You know what? You know what?
We got 15 minutes.
Yeah, you want to get me in a lawsuit. Now, how would that be? The professor's supposed to be the authority, right? I'd take advantage of this portal thing. His shoulders have swelled up, literally. His neck is thicker now than it was. How tall are you?
5'8".
Well, stand up.
You got 30 seconds,
Teddy. You're too small. You're too small. You see, I like the big guys because my vision is all his vulnerabilities. What does he see? Just his image in the mirror of my forehead. Right? Now, I'm just the kind of person, I like strong personality, dominant personality men. I work with men like that all the time. I gravitate toward them. I like the idea of the sons of thunder being in the kingdom of God. I like the idea of a Peter or Paul who's willing to get in your face. And I'll tell you, there's an integrity with some of those men that's lacking in some other kinds of men, because you at least know where they stand. One thing that drives me crazy is when somebody just is not willing to care enough for me to tell me what they really think, and they play games. I just have no time for that. Let me know what you think. Marvin and I, taking some trips, and, you know, we do some stuff, and on the way back, I said, well, here's what I didn't like about what you did. And he says, well, here's, you know, something about you that causes you perhaps to say that. And so pretty soon, we have a conversation on the way back, and it was good for me.
5 hours.
Yeah, that's right. And I like the idea. That's beneficial to me. Here's a male that does something for me that a woman cannot and will not do. And I need that from Marvin. I need you to get the hair on the back of your neck up, and I need you to come back with something. I still take you down, but I'll show you later. But here's the deal. The deal is that a woman does something for me as well that you cannot do. I'm not intimidated by the men. I'm just not. Maybe I should be, but I'm not. I've got an imagination from the yesteryear. But a woman often terrifies me. There's a kind of power that a woman has over me that's mysterious. And a man doesn't have that power over me. I'm willing to tell a man who doesn't want to hear what he needs to hear what he needs to hear. But when it comes to a woman, they don't hear the same way. It gets translated. It gets twisted around, doesn't it? Isn't that right? That's right, isn't it? And so I need what the men give me, but I need what the women give me. And the problem with the women is that with the men, I understand you. I understand exactly how you feel when I kind of play these games. I understand that. But I just don't understand it when my wife's telling me some of the stuff she's telling me. And so for me to have these needs met inside of me with her, I've got to grow up. I have to understand somebody who's radically different than me. That's good for me. So, one of the things I would like for you to notice is in Genesis chapter 3, there are these curses. And one of the things that is said here at the bottom, to the woman he said, "I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to your children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will..." What? Have we seen that emphasis before? It is not accidental. Before sin enters the picture, God has this ideal of male and female complementing each other and co-ruling. It is a co-rulership. But when sin comes into the picture, there is male power and there is female power. And now, whenever sin comes into the picture, now I use my power to exploit you, and you use your power to exploit me. And now she wants affection. She wants desire. But instead, I dominate her. Have women been oppressed? I think absolutely. But let me tell you something. If the women have been oppressed, how did that happen in the first place? The way it happened in the first place is that the male has a kind of power that can be more physically abusive. And so one nation says, "We have peace with another nation. Now, we're not going to war with you, but they know we would if we had to. We've got peace because we'll kill you if you don't take it on our terms." Now, we don't say that. But I'll tell you, it's interesting to watch a room full of people and watch how women try to influence people. They do it by verbally engaging. Men do it with their eyes, don't they? You know they do, don't you? You walk down the inner city somewhere, and I guarantee you, you walk into a prison, you better know how to deal with your eyes relative to the males. And it is that look. They're managing their environment. There's always this unspoken, "We will if we have to." That's how women have become oppressed. And so it's not a good thing. It's a bad thing. It's sin. But there is this natural tendency that we have to rule over each other now instead of ruling with each other. I want to encourage you. I think we're going to have about 10 minutes here for some time left at the end, but I want to help you see. I'm talking about something beyond gender, but it is expressed in gender, and it is this. Why am I created to be in a marriage now? It's because ultimately it's not about relating to a woman. It's the creation relating to the Creator, and there is no bigger gap. The gap between male and female is not as wide as the gap between creation and creator. And God is training me to understand one whom I am not. One who doesn't feel what I feel, think what I think, do what I do. And I learn to respect somebody who's different. And this is conditioning me to get outside of myself to relate to God. That's the purpose. And if you get this, it has automatic carryover. The problem with the role of women is the same problem we have with the generations in the churches. What's the bigger gap? The gap between a male and a female, or the gap between a 4-year-old and a 40-year-old? If you deal with the opposite gender well, you will automatically have emotional maturity and spiritual maturity that will carry over to you relating to people of a different generation well. I'll tell you, I'm a white guy. And if I have to be African American in order for us to connect, we're in trouble. Because I'm not capable. But what if what I have to do is learn to respect one whom I am not? Get outside of myself. All of a sudden, I see the value of that struggle. And if I'm doing that with my wife, that conditions me to do that with other people, different generations, different ethnic groups. It is even more complicated whenever you do mix in the gender and the generational reality. One of the things that I miss about ministry, you know, I've had a loss, a major, major loss in moving from ministry to teaching, and I'm here for a reason. And yet, there's a constant grief. Somebody asks me, do you like teaching better or being a minister? I'll tell you this, teaching is not nearly as rich an experience. Because I have you artificially extracted from your natural situation, put artificially with people who are like you in your phase of life. And I get to experience you in that way. In ministry, I get to experience you and a little brother or sister, a parent, a grandparent, a great-grandparent. That's a different fabric. And God has put us in these situations for a reason. My sons need the struggle of not understanding their 93-year-old grandmother. She's not 93 at this time, but she was well on her way. She's 93 now. My sons need. They do not need to be with all the kids their age all the time. I would much rather them be with somebody 40 or 50 years older and learn to adapt to them. Not just us adapting to the kids, but them adapting to somebody very, very different. Implications for homosexuality. Quickly, we'll just go over this and won't spend much time here. I think this is something that is very easy to misunderstand. I think understanding this biblical teaching on the genders is key. What else is homosexuality about? It's a gender issue. And it is a failure to relate to the opposite gender. Rather than ripping passages of Scripture out of context and throwing them against each other, what if we understood the biblical theology of Genesis? What if we understood that homosexuality is a rejection of relating to somebody who's different? And the homosexual community will tell me, wait a minute, you're not tolerant. You're not relating to people who are different. They have to be just like you. Homosexuality at its core is a rejection of relating to somebody who's different. And often, not always, but often what drives that is I just understand a man better and easier than I understand a woman. It's not as much work. A man will always understand a man easier than he will understand a woman. A woman will always understand a woman easier than she will understand a man. But I need that struggle. I need that frustration. Because if I don't have it, I will go comfortable and I'll not grow up.